and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, December 22nd, 2023. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. The headline from today's paper is Mystery Dog Illness, While Rarely Fatal, Rattles Owners by Emily Anderson. A difficult-to-track canine respiratory illness that has been spreading across the country has some dog owners thinking twice about taking their pets to dog parks and doggy daycare, but dog centers in the Cedar Rapids area say fear of the illness hasn't caused them to lose much business yet. Cases of the still unnamed respiratory disease started popping up in Oregon a couple of months ago and have spread around the country. It's difficult to track exactly where the disease has been spotted, however, because researchers haven't yet identified what pathogen is causing it. The illness has symptoms similar to kennel cough, a known canine respiratory illness, but it seems to last longer and doesn't respond well to antibiotics, according to Dr. Ryan Steen, a veterinarian with the Frey Pet Hospital in Cedar Rapids. The overwhelming majority of dogs who catch this illness do not have serious disease, though it sticks around a little bit. They get better, and it's only a tiny percentage that get more gravely ill. Steen said he had seen a couple of suspicious cases in Cedar Rapids, but it's hard to confirm whether it's the same respiratory illness that started in Oregon. We can't confirm something that we don't know what it is yet, if that makes sense. Coughing dogs, respiratory disease in dogs, is a very common thing. Seeing coughing dogs is not unusual at all. What makes this newer disease, or this most recent outbreak, different is that it seems to be not responsive to antibiotics, or not at all, and it sticks around a lot longer, Steen said. Treating an illness that doesn't respond to antibiotics often means managing symptoms, like using cough medicine, and hoping it eventually goes away on its own. That's not an entirely new situation, Steen said. There are a lot of viral infections that don't respond to antibiotics and have minimal treatment options. What's unique about this one is where more typical coughing conditions resolve after 7 to 10 days, this one seems to linger for several weeks, Steen said. We are working with the Iowa State Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, sending them samples, so it's not like nobody's working on it. Iowa State's not the only one. There are multiple states doing the same thing, so hopefully we'll get answers to these questions. In the meantime, Steen said concerned owners should make their dogs stay healthy in other ways, like making sure their vaccinations are all up to date and limiting exposure to large groups of unknown dogs. People whose dogs are very old or very young or are immunocompromised in other ways should be extra cautious with their dog's exposure to other animals. Short-nosed breeds, like bulldogs, are also at increased risk. Most canines shouldn't have too much to worry about, however, Steen said. The overwhelming majority of dogs who catch this illness do not have serious disease. Though it sticks around a little bit, they get better, and it's only a tiny percentage that get more gravely ill, Steen said. Sonia Brandley is the owner of Cedar Run Company in Hiawatha, which offers doggy daycare services as well as boarding services for vacations. Brandley said Cedar Run is completely booked for boarding this year over Christmas, but there have been fewer dogs coming in for daycare recently. It's definitely slower, but this is also our slow time of year, Brandley said. Christmas through New Year's were full, which is standard. I don't think people are going to not go see their family in another state. Brandley said she's been in constant contact with Cedar Rapids clients about the illness. She reached out when the disease was first being reported a few months ago to let dog owners know what to watch out for and ask them to keep their dogs at home if they are sick. A few people have called to ask whether the daycare has had any known cases, but as far as Brandley knows, none of the dogs she serves have caught the illness. The daycare also has been diligent in making sure to keep things as clean and safe as possible in the building. With the season changes, this is when we normally would see regular kennel cough. Our filtration systems are made for our industry. We leave our doors open a lot because of daycare, so fresh air, recycling the air, seems to help us out a lot, Brandley said. Marissa Meyer, manager at Dog Zone in Cedar Rapids, said the business also has been doing whatever possible to keep disease out of their facility. Dog Zone doesn't offer boarding services, just doggy daycare. "We are just cleaning everything. We haven't had any cases here, so we are knocking on wood and keeping our fingers crossed," Meyer said. Meyer said a few of Dog Zone's clients kept their dogs out of daycare for a few weeks after news of the illness first started to spread, but most of them have returned now. "It's just a risk that you run when you bring your dog to socialize, but they can also get it at the groomer and things. Just keep your dogs vaccinated and make sure you're going to clean facilities," Meyer said. The next story is Christmas tree growers are facing changing conditions. This is an Associated Press article. Dateline Chicago. Christmas tree breeder Jim Rakus knows what it looks like when one dies long before it can reach a buyer. Rakus farms trees in West Virginia and Pennsylvania, where he and other producers often grow their iconic evergreens outside their preferred habitat higher in the mountains. But that can mean planting in soil that's warmer and wetter, places where a nasty fungal disease called Phytopthora root rot can take hold, sucking moisture away from saplings and causing needles to crisp to burnt orange. "After a while, it just gets to the core of it," Rakus said. "It just withers away." Christmas tree growers and breeders have long prepared for a future of hot weather that will change soil conditions too. People buying trees may not have noticed a difference in availability this year, and may not even in the next couple. The average Christmas tree takes 8 to 10 years to reach marketable size, but that means the trees being grown right now are the beloved holiday traditions of tomorrow for millions of families. "You've got to start thinking about how you are going to adapt to this," Rakus said. That's why researchers such as Gary Kastiger, a Washington State University professor called Dr. Christmas Tree for his decades of work on firs and other festive species, have been working with breeders such as Rakus to see if species from other parts of the world, for instance, Turkish fir, are better adapted to conditions being wrought by climate change. In the past 2 years, surprisingly high numbers of evergreens died of fungal disease outbreaks in Washington and Oregon. Kastiger has been concerned that changing soil temperature and moisture may change the frequency of which we would see some phytopthora that are more adapted to warmer soil conditions. Some may attack trees even more aggressively, he added. Kastiger and his team are doing more sampling work to understand the causes of these outbreaks and whether they represent a pattern that could extend into the future. But some scientists say there isn't enough research on warming soil temperatures that could affect Christmas trees and many other crops, especially trees. A European study this year in the journal Nature Climate Change found that soil heat extremes are increasingly faster than air heat extremes, which can affect the health of grasslands, forests, and some agricultural areas. The same weather conditions that can put trees under stress favor many pests and diseases that can attack them, such as insects and fungi. "The changes in forests and farm fields might not happen overnight," said Bert Craig, a professor of horticulture and forestry at Michigan State University. "But over time, with a warming climate, some trees may become more difficult to grow," he said. "Changes in soil also have implications for soil carbon storage, a climate change solution that the U.S. has already put a lot of money and effort into researching. Warm soil temperatures reduce its long-term carbon storage ability, partly because microscopic life underground is affected," researchers say. "The activity of these microbes usually increases with temperature, so it's less stable to store carbon there," said Almudena Garcia-Garcia, one of the Nature Climate Change authors and a postdoctoral scientist at the Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research at UFZ in Leipzig, Germany. Although getting more information on how changing soils will affect crops and carbon alike is vital, some scientists sometimes struggle to get enough data, and Melissa Wildhelm, a Associate Director and Regional Climatologist at Purdue University's Midwestern Regional Climate Center. Since soil temperature is measured differently than air temperature, their records don't go back very far, making it difficult to understand long-term trends. Widholm, who was not involved with the Nature Climate Change research, said she wished more studies like it existed in other places like North America, and that the results are compelling because they combine physical observations in the ground with satellite data and computer simulation. This paper did a nice job quantifying soil temperature moisture relationships that scientists know exist but are difficult to measure, she said. Garcia said her team plans to study soil temperature changes more in the future in more locations if they can. All the sources of information indicate this is happening, she said. We are always studying extreme events from measurements in the air, but what is happening below our feet? Turning to page 2, Iowa Today. This story is titled, Donations Will Complete Wildlife Tracking System, by Brittany Miller. Thanks to recent donations, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources will be able to complete its statewide wildlife tracking system within the next 5 years. The MODIS wildlife tracking system includes receivers that automatically record signals from radio transmitters warned by tagged wildlife, using the data to track and study their movement and migrations. The network extends across 34 countries with more than 1,750 receiving stations, culminating in a public database with thousands of wildlife detections. The Iowa DNR joined the MODIS system in summer of 2021 thanks to a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services grant that funded equipment for 40 stations in the Midwest and a dozen in Central and South America. To date, there are 18 stations operating in Iowa, 9 by the Iowa DNR and 9 by its partners. They track tagged birds, bats, and insects as they migrate through the state. A total of $120,000 in recent donations will allow the Iowa DNR to complete its constellation of MODIS receivers. Diane Crookham Johnson and Musco Sports Lighting, both from Oskaloosa, each donated $60,000 in August to match the federal grants and purchase supplies in support of Iowa's MODIS system. Crookham Johnson, an avid birdwatcher who has spotted more than 200 species in the past 6 years, told the Iowa DNR she values the data collection system as a window into learning more about wildlife, especially in the classroom. Birds are everywhere. They're easy to see and relatable. I'm hoping to get students interested, Crookham Johnson, who volunteers at a local elementary school, said in an Iowa DNR news release. Whatever we can do to get kids excited about nature is good for the earth and good for mental health. The funding will allow the Iowa DNR to build 20 more stations, completing the coverage along the east-west middle of the state and complementing stations along its border rivers. Stations cost about $4,000 each and should last for 10 years. Iowa MODIS stations have recorded at least 66 detections of 57 individuals from 17 bird species since 2021, according to the Iowa DNR's 2022 annual report of the network. Some birds had been tagged as far away as Colombia and Costa Rica. A receiver placed in the Hawkeye Wildlife Management Area in Johnson County has detected 45 animals across 12 species since it was first installed in November 2021. Brittany J. Miller is the energy and environment reporter for the Gazette and a core member with Report for America, a national service program that places journalists in local newsrooms to report on undercovered issues. You can reach her at brittany.miller@thegazette.com or 319-398-8370. The next story is titled, State Freezes Grant for Benton County Well Water Testing, by Michaela Ram, Dateline Vinton. 2 months after the Benton County Board of Supervisors abruptly fired all members of the county's Board of Health, the county is wrestling with one of the repercussions of having no Local Health Board. Benton County can't sign new agreements with the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services, effectively freezing an approximately $50,000 state grant intended to help the county pay for private well water testing. Local officials have emphasized there's been no gaps in well water testing or other environmental health services within Benton County, which officials providing those services, state officials overseeing local public health and environmental services statewide, also insist there's been no disruptions for Benton County residents. The state has agreed to reimburse the county for the well water testing expenses it's incurring. HHS is not aware of any gaps in service in Benton County. Alex Carfrey, Public Information Officer for Iowa Health and Human Services, said in a statement, "Our local public health services team is working closely with the county to ensure the continuity in services and to find solutions to finalize the pending contract with the Benton County Board of Health. However, it's unclear to the County Board of Supervisors when it can appoint a new Board of Health and resume the state agreements because of a pending lawsuit with the former members of the Health Board who were terminated in October. Until that litigation is settled, the county supervisors can't appoint a new board," said Tracy Seaman, chair of the Benton County Board of Supervisors. Gray Schmidt, director of Benton County Public Health, said in an email to the Register, "My department anticipates the upcoming appointment of a local Board of Health for Benton County and is looking forward to both growing our team and sharing with community partners the work being done in support of improved community health as we enter the new year." On October 3rd, the Benton County Board of Supervisors issued termination letters to all five members of the Benton County Board of Health. The supervisors later said the reason for the board members' terminations was to reverse the 130% increase in the budget implemented by the County Health Board. The former Board of Health had requested an amendment to the county's budget for additional funds to hire a full-time public health staff member. That request represented an approximately 74% increase in its budget. However, accounting for anticipated state funding, the request would be a 19% increase in taxpayer funds. The Board of Supervisors had approved the public health budget amendment October 3rd, the same day termination notices were sent to Board of Health members. The supervisors have offered no further explanation on why terminating the board was necessary to reverse the approved budget amendment. The former health board members say they were blindsided by their abrupt firing. Until they received termination notices, the former members believe they were working toward an initiative that was supported by the Board of Supervisors, said Margaret Mangold, former chair of the Board of Health. In Iowa, each county has a Board of Health to oversee environmental health and public health services within that county. These boards have the authority to carry out necessary health functions, including hiring staff and signing agreements between agencies for contract work or grant opportunities. Iowa's Health and Human Services Agency maintains contracts with all 99 counties to fund health-related programs and services. But typically, those contracts with local partners are between the state and county boards of health, Carfrey said. This is the case for Benton County, whose Board of Health serves as the entity on grant agreements with the state. Without a standing Board of Health in Benton County, this department is not entertaining new or revised grants and contracts at this time, Schmidt said. The state contract, pending a signature from a new Benton County Board of Health, as required by Iowa Code, is part of the state's Grants to Counties program, totaling $50,505 for the fiscal year. The state has agreed to reimburse the county for expenses incurred on well testing under the contract retroactivity from July 1, 2023, Carfrey said. So far, the county is waiting for $2,676.50 in reimbursement from the state program, said Matt Even, environmental health and land use technician for Benton County. Iowa Health and Human Services has two current contracts with Benton County to provide funding for health-related services, including a $65,580 grant to ensure core public health functions are met, Carfrey said. The second is a vaccine response and equity grant to provide routine vaccinations to underserved communities. To date, the county has spent $45,963, Carfrae said. Schmidt said, "In the interim, my department has been successfully completing routine duties, including disease investigation, school and licensed childcare immunization audits, community health education, and emergency preparedness training." The five former members of the Board of Health have filed a lawsuit against the Board of Supervisors, Benton County, and three county supervisors individually, Seaman, Rick Primer, and Gary Bierschenk. The lawsuit alleges the former Board of Health members were wrongfully terminated from their positions, quote, without warning and without, quote, good reason. It also asks a judge to affirm the supervisors violated Iowa law by conducting unofficial closed-door meetings. Lawyers for both parties are expected to come together after the new year for a mediation hearing, Mangold said. On page 3, we have this story. Iowa DNR fines the developer of Tiffin's Park Place by Aaron Jordan. A Johnson County developer has agreed to pay a $4,000 penalty for stormwater violations during construction of Park Place, a 450-acre multi-use development that includes Pin Seekers in Tiffin. Durr's Development agrees to pay the fine within 30 days and stop illegal discharges to the Spencer Creek watershed, according to the enforcement order released Thursday. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources did a routine inspection of the site south of Forever Green Road and west of Interstate 380 on July 24th. The inspector found erosion in several places and inadequate protections against erosion and sediment migration, the order states. Evidence of a discharge of sediment-laden stormwater was observed to have flowed south from the end of the Pin Seekers facility to the adjacent field, the DNR reported. The DNR sent DERS a notice of violation July 31st. The agency said half the fine, $2,000, was assessed because that was the estimated economic benefit DERS obtained through avoiding the cost of installing and maintaining adequate stormwater erosion and sediment control measures throughout the construction site. The Park Place development will include housing, entertainment, restaurants, and shopping. Pin Seekers, a year-round hybrid golf and gaming facility, opened last month. Now turning to the Insight page and the Gazette's editorial. It's titled, New Westside Library Plan is Unique. City staff unveiled a list of potential amenities that will be included in the Westside Library project, particularly on parkland surrounding the new facility. The possibilities are impressive. Creating a park alongside the new library makes the plan unique. According to reporting by the Gazette's Marissa Payne, a portion of the park would be a bioretention area with trees and native plantings. Basketball courts would include space for a condensed version of soccer. During the winter, the courts could be flooded for a skating rink. Planners hope to improve traditional splash pads by offering pads that fit the natural landscape, more like a backyard or stream. Outdoor reading rooms provide space for outdoor reading. A secluded, rentable pavilion is planned near a playground and restroom facilities, and a civic forum feature could be a site for larger events. It could accommodate up to 100 people or possibly 1,000. Plans include community garden plots accessible by people with disabilities and a discovery garden with native plantings. Trails in the park would be built to connect with other regional trails. The new library at the corner of 20th Avenue and Wiley Boulevard Southwest will replace the current Ladd Library at 3750 Williams Boulevard Southwest. The leased space that has housed Ladd since 2013 was meant to be temporary. These are exciting plans, to be sure, but the library must raise the dollars needed to make the $19 million library plan a reality. The Cedar Rapids Public Library Foundation has pledged $2 million, along with $4 million from Linn County and $6 million from the City of Cedar Rapids. The county and city used Federal American Rescue Plan Act funds to support the project. The public phase of the fundraising campaign will be unveiled in January. Community support will be key to covering project costs and making sure planned amenities on paper happen in reality. The fact that we're going to get a brand new building and it's going to be so gorgeous and have so many amenities in addition to it is a big deal, City Council Member Ashley Vanorni said. It's a really big deal for those neighborhoods, particularly because they specifically, with the 2020 derecho, were hit some of the hardest. We agree. The new library will be a major asset for the neighborhood and the entire West Side. The library plans to seek bids on the project in May, with construction set to begin in the late summer. The projects will take 2 years to finish, but from what we've seen, it's worth the wait. Now, this story by Aaron Murphy, titled, Iowa Delegation Criticizes Rail Closures, Says They Could Hurt Farmers. Dateline Des Moines. Two major rail crossings in Texas have been temporarily closed to address an influx of migrants crossing into the U.S., a move Iowa's all-Republican congressional delegation sharply criticized this week in a letter to President Joe Biden's administration, citing concerns about the potential impact on Iowa agriculture exports. In a letter dated Wednesday, the Iowa delegation expressed grave concerns with the Biden administration's closing of major rail crossings between Eagle Pass and El Paso, Texas. U.S. Customs and Border Protection said the closures are meant to address a recent resurgence of smuggling organizations moving migrants through Mexico via freight trains. The closures will free up customs officers to assist overwhelmed U.S. Border Patrol agents who need to take migrants into custody, the Associated Press reported. In their letter to Biden, the Iowa Republicans called the closures a short-sighted decision that punishes farmers and small businesses. In addition to scathing criticism of the Biden administration's immigration policy and enforcement, the letter notes the impact the rail crossing closures could have on the movement of agricultural goods. More than a third of U.S. trade with Mexico moves through the two closed crossings, and for every day the crossings are closed, 60 trains sit idle and 4,500 rail cars face delay, the letter notes. Mexico is the second largest purchaser of Iowa goods, according to state and federal trade data. Iowa proudly leads the country in agriculture, with our farmers working day in, day out to feed and fuel the world, the Iowa delegation's letter reads. The importance of rail for transporting Iowa's grain and agricultural products across the country cannot be overstated. The letter is signed by U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, and U.S. Representatives Marionette Miller-Meeks, Ashley Hinson, Zach Nunn, and Randy Feenstra. Agricultural groups and railroad industry leaders also have criticized the closures. In a response to the Gazette, the White House said the temporary action was needed to address a large number of migrants coming into the U.S. by rail. DHS took this temporary action in order to stop a large movement of migrants coming by rail and to protect the health and safety of its personnel, a White House spokesman said in an email to the Gazette. We are working closely with the Mexican government in an attempt to resolve this issue and also surging personnel to the region. We are communicating regularly with the industry leaders to ensure we are assessing and mitigating the impacts of these temporary closures. Union Pacific estimated its losses in goods, wages, and transportation costs will exceed $200 million a day if the crossings in both cities remain closed, the Associated Press reported. The rail cars carry many products, including agricultural products such as grain, cars, food and beverage, and industrial commodities, the Associated Press reported. Migrants often board trains from Mexico into the U.S., but railroad companies also have technologies and systems in place to deter and discover people and contraband entering the country illegally, the Associated Press reported. Union Pacific told the AP it found only 5 migrants trying to enter the U.S. illegally in the past 5 weeks. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, December 22nd, 2023. on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Next, we'll turn to today's obituaries. Ricky Lee Hard, Cedar Rapids. Ricky Lee Hard, 67, of Cedar Rapids, died December 18, 2023. Ricky was survived by his daughters Melissa, Michelle, Brittany, Katie, Kate, Cassie, stepkids Connie, Casey, Chelsea, Courtney, and Chris, sons Big Ricky, Little Ricky, Danny, and ex-wives Michelle and Laura. He will be missed by family and friends. Gerald Raymond Alberhasky, Iowa City. Gerald Raymond Alberhasky, 77, died peacefully Saturday, December 17, 2023, at UIHC. Massive Christian burial will be celebrated at 10 a.m. Friday, December 29, 2023, at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Iowa City. Visitation will be Thursday, December 28, 2023, from 3:30 to 6 p.m. at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. The rosary will be recited at 3 p.m. The service will be live-streamed on the St. Mary Catholic Church, Iowa City YouTube page. Burial with military honors will be at St. Joseph Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to St. Mary's Catholic Church or the Regina Foundation. Cleota Toby Branham. Cleota Toby Branham, 85, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away on Sunday, December 17, 2023, at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital. A visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. on Tuesday, December 26, 2023, at St. Mark's United Methodist Church, 4700 Johnson Avenue Northwest, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, 52405. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, December 27, 2023, at the church, with a visitation beginning 1 hour prior. Gary Richard Simon, Cedar Rapids. It is with deepest sorrow we announce the death of Gary Richard Simon, 88, of Colorado City, Colorado, formerly of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He passed away peacefully, surrounded by loved ones, on Thursday, December 14, 2023. To honor Gary's memory, a celebration of life will be held in Cedar Rapids at a date to be announced later. To honor Gary's adventurous spirit, the family requests those who wish to express sympathy to make a donation to the National Parks Conservation Association in Gary's name. Condolences may be left at cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Scott Vannard Schaffstall, Mechanicsville. Scott Vannard Schaffstall, 52, of Mechanicsville, passed away on Thursday, December 21st, 2023, from complications of pancreatic cancer while under the care of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Visitation will be held on Saturday, December 23rd from noon to 2 p.m. at Fry Funeral Home in Tipton, and funeral services will follow at 2 p.m. also at the funeral home. Burial and military honors will conclude at Rose Hill Cemetery in Mechanicsville, Iowa. A memorial for pancreatic research in the name of Scott Schaffstall has been created in lieu of flowers. Online condolences may be shared at fryfuneralhome.com. In other notices, Kalmar. Clinton Frana, 73, died Wednesday, December 20th, 2023, Helms Funeral Home, Decorah. Cedar Rapids. Burdette Johnson, 90, died Tuesday, December 19th, 2023, Iowa Cremation. Cedar Rapids. Douglas Northrup, 72, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, December 20th, 2023, Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center. Harper's Ferry. Cynthia Foley, 69, died Sunday, December 17th, 2023, Martin Grau Funeral Home, Waukon. Lansing. Leo J. Delaney, 84, of Tomball, Texas, formerly of Lansing, died Monday, December 18th, 2023, Thornburg Grau Funeral Home. Marion. Julie Ann Cody, 79, died Wednesday, December 20th, 2023, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. And Waverly Jack Joseph Tripolino, 93, died Monday, December 18th, 2023, Kaiser Corson Funeral Home. We'll start this sports page today with On Television, live first run, same day tape. NBA. The Nuggets at the Nets, 6:30 p.m., NBA TV. Wizards at Warriors, 9 p.m., ESPN. National Hockey League, Canadiens at Blackhawks, 7:30 p.m., NBCS, Chicago. College football, Union Home Mortgage, Gasparilla Bowl. Georgia Tech versus UCF, 5:30 p.m., on ESPN. In men's basketball, Diamond Head Classic, 4 p.m., 10 p.m., 12:30 a.m., ESPN2. Georgetown at Marquette, 6 p.m., FS1. Chicago State at Wisconsin, 7 p.m., BTN. Maryland at UCLA, 8 p.m., ESPN2. Illinois versus Missouri, 8 p.m., FS1. In women's basketball, Bowling Green at Indiana, 5 p.m. on BTN. In pro soccer, Aston Villa at Sheffield United, 2 p.m. USA. NBA G League Winter Showcase, 12:30 p.m. ESPNU, 6 p.m. ESPN2. Girls basketball, Iowa City High at Iowa City West, 6 p.m. KCRG, 9.2. Boys basketball, Iowa City High at Iowa City West, 7:30 p.m. KCRG, 9.2. On the radio, local talk shows. Todd Brommelkamp Show, 6:30 a.m., KGYM. Gym Class, 3 p.m., KGYM. Spencer on Sports, 4 p.m., KGYM. And these listings were submitted by the radio stations. And events of area interest in boys basketball, Jefferson at Prairie, 7:30 p.m., Washington at Kennedy, 7:30. City High at Iowa City West, 7:30. Xavier at Liberty, 7:30. Waterloo West at Linmar, 7:30. In girls basketball, Washington at Kennedy, 6 p.m. Jefferson at Prairie at 6 p.m. City High at Iowa City West, 6. Xavier at Liberty, 6. Linmar at Waterloo West, 7:30. In boys wrestling, Regina at New London Tournament, 10 a.m. And in pro hockey, Fort Wayne at Iowa Heartlanders, 7:05 p.m. Now to more high school sports and girls basketball, we have this story titled Increased Delegation, Uncanny Depth by Jeff Linder. Year two of the Kenyon Murray era has revolved around two buzzwords, delegation and depth. Let's take these one at a time. Delegation first. One thing we're doing different is that we're running the program more like a football team, said Murray, head girls basketball coach at rapidly ascendant Cedar Rapids Prairie. Assistant coaches are more like coordinators. Steve Stumpf is in charge of defense, Murray said. Scott Legat handles our press and press break. Ashley Grimm runs our out-of-bounds plays. I wanted them to have an equal voice so that the girls can tap into the assistants when I'm up coaching. The assistants aren't the only ones with a greater voice this season. It's more of a players-led team, Murray said. We have a seniors leadership group. Kids like Ryan Decker have really stepped up vocally, and the unit as a whole has done the same in terms of the bottom line. A 10-12 team in Murray's debut season, Prairie is 6-1 heading into its December finale tonight at home against Cedar Rapids Jefferson. The Hawks suffered an 83-42 season opening loss to Johnston, but has rattled off six consecutive victories by an average margin of 23 points. That's where the depth comes in. Murray can effectively run a rotation of 11 players. Seven are averaging at least 4 points per game, led by sophomores Emily Larson and Brinley Hodenfelt. Freshman point guard Kiana Worley has an assist to turnover count of 26-8. With our depth, that makes our defense really effective, Murray said. We're able to run different stuff at teams. And our pace. Shooting comes and goes, but when we play with pace, we're able to get the team's benches. Reserves make up about 37% of the Hawks' scoring. That crew includes seniors like Decker, McKenna Murray, Kenyon's daughter, and Katie Redinger, plus junior Asia Beal, who is third on the team in scoring at 7.6 points per game. It seems like a different girl or girls every night, Murray said, At 4-0 in Mississippi Valley Conference play, the Hawks are tied for first place in the Mississippi Division with Dubuque Wallard and Cedar Falls. They play those teams in succession January 5th and January 9th. Lone Tree winning, led by a defense that allows 30.1 points and collects 19.1 steals per game, fifth best in the state. Lone Tree is the area's first team to 10 wins. The Lions are 10-1 and have concluded play until January 2nd. Six different players are contributing heavily to that steals total, led by junior Vivian Zaruba. That helps offset the Lions' 33% field goal shooting. Offensively, the team is sophomore-driven. Finley Jake led at 17.9 points per game, followed by classmates Ava Christofferson and Allison Ford. Now turning to boys basketball. Pairings are set for MVC-CIML crossover by Jeff Johnson, Dateline Cedar Rapids. Pairings for the Serve Pro MVC-CIML crossover shootout have been set. The first of its kind event is January 6th at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse in downtown Cedar Rapids. Tickets go on sale today and will be available online at Ticketmaster. The crossover features seven boys basketball games, mostly between schools from the Mississippi Valley Conference, Mississippi Athletic Conference, and Central Iowa Metro League. A return event is scheduled for Central Iowa later in January, with three games on tap. This is the brainchild of Cedar Rapids Kennedy coach John McCowan and has the blessing of the Iowa High School Athletic Association. McCowan wanted schools from Central Iowa and Eastern Iowa to compete against each other. I have been in conversations with coaches across the state every year about seeding when it comes to sub-state and the state tournament, McCowan said. There is no perfect system, but the IHSAA has been a great partner with the IBCA, Iowa Basketball Coaches Association, to modify the system seeding criteria from coaches' recommendations. In hopes of creating more clarity to the process, I thought it would be great to have in-season matchups from the best teams across the state. This is also going to allow the student athletes on each team to play in an arena that will be a special experience for them. The January 6th event begins at 10 a.m. when Cedar Rapids Prairie and Southeast Polk play. Iowa City Liberty and Waukon Northwest follow at approximately 11:30. The crossover continues with a 1 p.m. matchup between Pleasant Valley and Ames, and then it's Bettendorf and Ankeny at about 2:30. The 4 p.m. game is between Cedar Falls and Davenport Assumption. The event concludes with a 5:30 contest between Linmar and West Des Moines Valley and a 7 p.m. contest between Kennedy and Waukee. McCowan had the three members of the IHSAA Class 4A Rankings Poll Committee, former Bettendorf head coach and current administrator Kevin Skillett, former Waukee head coach, current middle school activities director Justin Ohl, and Jeff Johnson of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, put together the tournament pairing so as to avoid a conflict of interest. The goal was to match up similar teams. Iowa City West and West Des Moines Dowling also are playing an MBC-CIML game January 6th at West. Assumption was a substitute for Johnston, which had a schedule conflict and could not attend the event. McCowan said he hopes other schools will opt to play in the crossover event in future years. I would like to thank the 17 different schools that agreed to play in these two events, he said. We will have 12 competitive games over the 2 days. Rankings. The Iowa High School Athletic Association is expected to release its first official state rankings of the season today. The rankings are compiled by four separate committees, one for each class, that include two former coaches, a media member, and members of the IHSAA staff. Now we have this article about boys swimming. Pool at Prairie will give Cedar Rapids fourth prep team by Mike Condon. A vote last November in the College Community School District will likely change the high school swimming landscape in Cedar Rapids very soon. District voters approved a $43 million general obligation bond issue that will fund construction of a swimming pool and wellness center that will be operated by the YMCA. The facility, which will be located across from Prairie Crest Elementary, could open as early as January 2025. Another likely outcome of the vote is Cedar Rapids Prairie will have its own swimming team. Over the years, any Prairie student wanting to swim had to be part of a co-op program, first with Williamsburg and then, since 2011, with Cedar Rapids Jefferson. I was very excited about the community support for the CCSD bond, said Jessica Hinkey, who teaches at Prairie and is the head coach for both boys and girls programs at Jefferson. We worked hard to get the word out to the community and make sure the bond was relevant for everyone in the community. Ever since I was in high school at Jefferson, from 2003 to 2007, I've been a supporter of Prairie Needs a Pool. The passage of the bond issue also will fund improvements to John Wall Stadium and provide additional practice space for wrestling, baseball, and softball. But the centerpiece of the plan is the Aquatic Center and Wellness Center, which will have a competition-sized pool with diving and seating for spectators, a recreational pool with a splash pad, a walking and running track, basketball and multi-purpose courts, and a cardio and weightlifting area. Hinkey said plans already are in the works for Prairie to have its own team once the facility is up and running. I know we are planning to start a high school team as soon as the pool is built, she said. We already have the numbers. For the last 5 years that I have coached the Jefferson's girls team, there have been more Prairie students than Jefferson students on that team. The boys' team has always been more evenly split until this year. 12 of the 17 boys on the team go to Prairie. I think having the pool on campus and more easily accessible will encourage more students to try and stick with swimming. The fact efforts have stalled on a plan to build a new aquatic facility for the Cedar Rapids Community School District to replace aging facilities at Kennedy, Washington, and Jefferson is not lost on Hinkey. I can't ignore that I'm in a tough spot, being a Jefferson grad and alum of the Jefferson swim team and the current head coach for both girls and boys high school teams, she said. I obviously want what's best for the Jefferson swim team, but at the same time, I see how important this pool is for the community as a whole, and especially CCSD. As a parent of a kindergartner in CCSD, Hinkey said this, she is very excited about having a pool so close to school and so much more easily accessible for swim lessons, honoring crews. It is bound to be an emotional night when Washington hosts Kennedy on January 2nd to start the 2024 portion of the season for both teams. Not only will it be senior night for the Warriors, but the memory of longtime Washington coach Chris Cruz will be honored. Cruz, who was an all-state swimmer and coached at Washington from 1998 to 2021, died in September after a short battle with pancreatic cancer. We are asking for all alums to come and honor Cruz and support our swimmers, Warrior coach Matt Sinnott said. Now turning to women's basketball, this story is titled Reality Check for Hawkeyes by Jeff Linder. For much of the first half, Loyola Chicago was the equal, if not the superior, to the Iowa Hawkeyes. Reality came later. Caitlin Clark notched her 13th career triple-double, 35 points, a career-high 17 rebounds and 10 assists. And number 4 Iowa eventually ran away from the Ramblers, 98-69, in a non-conference women's basketball game before an announced crowd of 14,998 Thursday night at Carver Hawkeye Arena. Also in the house were Indiana Fever head coach Christy Sides and two of her assistants. And surely they weren't disappointed. They departed after Clark's 10th assist. The Fever have the first pick in April's WNBA draft, and the consensus is that they will select Clark if she opts to go pro after this season. Iowa won its 9th straight game and resumes Big Ten play for good December 30th at home against Minnesota. The Hawkeyes were without Gabby Marshall for unspecified reasons. They were sluggish throughout most of the first half. They trailed throughout most of the second quarter. The largest deficit was 35-28 at the 6:38 mark. But they put up 23 points from that point until halftime and, despite 8 3-pointers from the Ramblers, worked their way to a 51-46 advantage by intermission. It was 79-61 by the end of the third quarter, and the Hawkeyes put a bow on it with the final 13 points. With 3,114 career points, Clark climbed to number 7 on the all-time career scoring chart, passing Rachel Banham at 3,093 and Jerrica Coley at 3,107. Next up is Drake great Lori Bauman at 3,115. Cedar Rapids native Hannah Stuhlke added 20 points and grabbed 8 rebounds. Kate Martin scored 19 and Sydney Affelter 10. Iowa owned a 51-27 advantage on the glass and hit 21 of 27 free throws, compared to 4 of 7 for the Loyola Ramblers. The Ramblers made 13 three-pointers in 35 attempts. In men's basketball, Harding's Dozen Dimes helped fill Hawkeyes' meter by my class. Freshman guard Brock Harding said he doesn't keep track of his stats, so he doesn't know if his 12 assists Wednesday night marked a personal best. He knew when he had 8 of them in Iowa's 103-81 win over UMBC before an announced crowd of 8,357 at Carver Hawkeye Arena, though. Senior teammate Tony Perkins told him, "How Perkins knew isn't clear, but players know if they want to know. Today, when he 8 points and 8 assists, I told him, when you get in there, I told him, score your 2 and then get 2 assists," Perkins said. Harding got his 2 points, got the 2 assists, then got 2 more assists. It was a 10-point, 12-assist, 4-steal game. After answering reporters' questions, Harding returned to the Carver court to get more shots up. "You may have read it here before, and you're reading it here again. This kid can play. No Hawkeye has had as many assists in a game since Jordan Bohannon's 14 in January 2021. Lackluster defense combined with good shooting by UMBC kept the Retrievers of Maryland Baltimore County in the game for a while. In fact, it was tied with 5 minutes left in the first half. Perkins and Harding keyed a blitz, and Iowa was up 50-36 at the break. The lead got as big as 28 points. Perkins had a season-high 23 points, 7 assists, 6 rebounds, and 4 steals. Harding had a steal he turned into a setup for a second-half Perkins dunk. About 3 minutes later, Perkins swiped the ball and returned the favor to his younger friend. You'll be seeing a lot more of Harding at point guard, and this won't be his only double-digit assist game. We've got so many guys that are so good off the ball, cutting, back cuts. That opens up 3, opens up layups, so many cutters. That just makes my job so much easier. Great cutters, great players. It's just so much fun to play with them." Iowa had some sharp-looking team stats like 50% shooting, 33 assists, a 47-36 rebounding edge, and a season-low 4 turnovers. It wasn't a game Hawkeyes coach Fran McCaffrey was crazy about, however. "Our defense was not good at the start of the game at all," McCaffrey said. "Once we got up 25, our defense softened like it was at the start of the game." So Iowa is 7-5 for Christmas, with the next game not until December 29th against Northern Illinois here. 6 of the 7 wins came against mid-majors. Christmas cheer can come from the possibility Harding and center Owen Freeman have just begun on Iowa careers with great promise. "Harding," McCaffrey said, "is an incredible competitor. He's got a tremendous mind for the game, and he truly understands what is needed at any given time. He knew we needed to get some stops, get some runouts, hit some cutters, get some layups, get to the free throw line. We were in the double bonus pretty early because he was driving the ball. You had a bunch of guys in double figures because of him. Peyton Sanford had 18 points and 10 rebounds. Ben Cricky had 17 and 12. Patrick McCaffrey had 14 points. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for December 22nd, 2023. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.